This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
President Trump is halting some visas for foreign tech workers, promising jobs to Americans. Economists say that's backwards thinking. The U.S. thrives because of foreign workers.
If we progressively reduce those, not only we will not substitute American jobs, but we will slow the growth of the American economy.
Also, the coronavirus is spiking in Egypt, but holding the government in Cairo accountable comes with more risk.
Detentions and arrests are creating frustration and fear among doctors.
And 10 children arrive in France, removed from squalid detention camps in Syria. Their parents, allied with ISIS, are originally from France. Hundreds of children remain behind.
The mothers in the camp basically said, "I'm not giving my child to a non-believer, to a kind of infidel government."
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us today. It's been a big week for President Trump's immigration policies. Yesterday, he flew to Arizona, visited the U.S.-Mexico border, and toured and touted upgrades to the border wall. He also announced another crackdown on people coming to the U.S., an executive order targeting several visa programs for foreign workers, including high-tech workers. The move has been fiercely opposed by American business leaders, and as The World's Lydia Emanuelidou reports, the tech industry is pushing back.
The visas we're talking about are called H-1Bs. They're meant for people with highly specialized skills in fields like science, engineering, computer programming. H-1Bs are really popular in the tech industry. Companies including Amazon, Google, Apple, IBM use them to bring in top talent from abroad. The vast majority of these visas go to people from India.
We're aggressively trying to find the best technical talent in the world. And we'd love to do that in the U.S., but there is a shortage in the U.S.
Todd McKinnon is the co-founder and CEO of Okta, a software company based in San Francisco. He says they've got a couple hundred people, about 7% of the staff, on these visas. But they actually need more, and Trump's executive order is going to prevent that from happening.
It's frustrating because, you know, we're a U.S. company, and we want U.S. companies to be super successful and competitive, and things like this really make it harder.
Because of the pandemic, there's more demand for IT and other online services tech companies like Okta provide. So McKinnon says it's an especially bad time to limit who they can hire. This isn't the first time Trump and his administration have gone after foreign worker visas. Trump made H-1B a campaign issue. Here he is during a CNN debate in 2016.
It's very bad. It's very bad for business it's very bad for our workers, and it's unfair for our workers, and we should end it.
Today, the Trump administration says that pausing H-1Bs will help the economy recover from the damage caused by the pandemic. But Giovanni Perry says there's actually good evidence that H-1B and similar programs are good for the economy. Perry's a professor of economics at the University of California, Davis. He's also the founder and director of the UC Davis Global Migration Center.
In a research that we did, we showed that in cities where more H-1B visa come, American workers are more likely to be employed, American workers are paid more, and local company grow faster.
He says his research shows that in the aggregate, H-1B is a big engine for the American economy.
Is a little stimulus like to the American economy having these workers. If we progressively reduce those, in the longer run, not only we will not substitute American jobs, but we will slow the growth of the American economy.
There are critics who say companies can use these visas to hire workers for lower wages, that there are issues with the way the visas are distributed. Even the program's supporters admit it's not perfect. But they say without it, companies that have relied on H-1B workers might move operations outside of the U.S. to outsourcing firms, or they might set up offices abroad so they can hire people locally. That's something Todd McKinnon with Okta is already doing.
So we have a pretty significant R&D presence in Toronto, in Canada. And that would be much smaller if these H-1Bs weren't such an issue.
Having an office in Canada means they can hire people there without needing to bring them to the U.S. But with work from home becoming the norm because of the pandemic, McKinnon says they're also looking into setting up Okta as a legal entity in other countries so they can hire foreign workers to work from home without needing to go into an office and without needing an H-1B visa. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
Representatives from Kosovo and Serbia are scheduled to hold talks at the White House this weekend, but that meeting's hit a major stumbling block. Kosovo's president, Hashim Thaci, has been charged with war crimes by a special prosecutor in The Hague. The allegations against Thaci relate to the Kosovo War in the late 1990s. Tim Judah is Balkans correspondent with our friends at The Economist.
Well, he's been charged with crimes against humanity, war crimes, the murder, enforced disappearance of persons, persecution and torture. And it says that he and Kadri Vaseli, who is the head of Mr. Thaci's political party, have been charged with being criminally responsible for nearly 100 murders. Now, what's important to understand is that at this stage, this is the prosecution charging these two. They haven't been indicted. So what has to happen is that a pre-trial judge has to approve the charges, and then they will be indicted. So at the moment, these are just charges. But normally, these things are secret. No one has ever been put on trial yet by this special court. And, we'll just have to wait and see what happens. But it's politically dynamite. I mean, this is the most explosive thing that's happened in Kosovo and in the Balkans for years.
So this meeting at the White House this weekend, apparently Thaci was already en route to Washington. So was this ruling expected, and what happened once this ruling came down?
What happened was that Mr. Thaci went to Tirana in Albania, and he was then supposed to set off for Washington. So we don't really know how far he got, but at the moment he's apparently in Germany and is now heading home. The talks were organized by Ambassador Rick Grenell, former ambassador to Germany and the former acting director of national intelligence. So he was the person who put all the effort into organizing it. And then he has said that Mr. Thaci has now pulled out, but he is saying that the talks will still go ahead. But I'm not so sure. I mean, I may prove to be wrong, but a meeting between the Serbian president and a very weak and very new Prime Minister of Kosovo, who is absolutely not his equal, doesn't make sense. I mean, it makes sense to have a meeting of two equals, but, you know, one big man in inverted commas and one not so big man, I'm not so sure that politically that's a runner.
So what is the current situation between Serbia and Kosovo, the two nations that were due to meet in Washington this weekend for talks? Does Serbia still not recognize Kosovo as an independent state?
Serbia certainly doesn't recognize Kosovo as an independent state. I mean, the Kosovo War ended in 1999, then Kosovo declared independence in 2008, and Serbia rejects its independence. Having said that, Mr. Vucic, the Serbian president, although he says that he will never recognize Kosovo, I mean, he is something of a realist and he wants to strike some sort of deal. And Mr. Thaci, too, wants some sort of deal. What's controversial is what could be in that deal. And one of the things that has been talked about a lot in the last couple of years is the possibility of land swaps and territorial exchanges. Now, Mr. Grenell and Mr. Thaci have been sort of backing off from that. But we don't know what was on the agenda, apart from economics, for this meeting that was supposed to happen on Saturday.
That's Tim Judah, Balkans correspondent with The Economist. Until last month, Egypt appeared to be pretty much in control of the coronavirus, but cases are spiking this month, approaching 2,000 a day. Egypt now has the most coronavirus-related deaths in Africa. Egypt's medical union has warned that the nation's healthcare system could soon collapse. How you would find out about that, though, is not clear. The government has been silencing critics of its response to the pandemic. It's arresting doctors and journalists. Hussein Baoumi is an Egypt researcher at Amnesty International. He joins us from Tunisia's capital, Tunis. So since late May, Hussein, the number of reported infections and deaths in Egypt from COVID-19 has more than tripled. What do you think has changed over the past few weeks?
It's very difficult to say as actual figures in Egypt, particularly because of the absolute lack of transparency on the part of the Egyptian authorities, but also the way that they have been dealing with anyone who tries to present any different message that the authorities would like to point out. And I would point out to a survey done by organization based in Egypt, which has found that more than 600,000 Egyptians over the age of 18 have had coronavirus. I mean, but this is based on phone interviews and a survey from that sort. So, I mean, it's not super scientific, but it's kind of telling when the difference is so high between what people are saying and what the government is saying.
So hospitals are full. You can't find ICU beds, PPE seriously lacking, and hundreds of medical staff infected. I mean, what's your assessment of how the government in Egypt is handling the coronavirus?
The way that they have been handling the coronavirus has been pretty much the way that they have handled other issues or crises that have been facing Egypt. So they have responded first and foremost by cracking down on dissenting voices. And here I point out the crackdown on doctors, where several doctors and medical professionals have been arrested because they have voiced their concerns about lack of protection equipment, or they have voiced concerns about the ways that the government has been dealing with the coronavirus.
So I was going to ask you about the government's arresting journalists and doctors, labeling them enemies of the state. It sounds like you would say that's just the usual MO of the Sisi regime.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a go-to for the Egyptian government. If you voice concerns about how any issue is being handled, you are automatically labeled as enemy of the country. You are labeled as Muslim Brotherhood. They are questioned by the special branch of the prosecution that's responsible for prosecuting terrorism cases. And then they are detained in pretrial, held in pretrial detention for months or even years with zero chance of actually being moved to trial just because these are, you know, like these are pretty much administrative detention cases.
That is stunning. I mean, to call doctors enemies of the state. What are your concerns, Hussein, about the consequences for the state of Egypt and its ability to address the coronavirus if these cases keep spiking?
I mean, the issue of doctors, the crackdown on doctors, I mean, the Egyptian authorities have actually arrested quite a large number of doctors even before that. And these arrests have also had extremely bad impact on doctors, and this is according to the doctor syndicate. So they released a statement on the 14th of June, if I remember correctly, and basically they were saying that these detentions and arrests, they are creating frustration and fear among doctors. And this is a rare criticism from the doctor syndicate in Egypt, because they are not really politically opposed to the government or any of that. But when they actually raise that concern, then you know for a fact that these arrests are adversely harming the morale among the doctors in Egypt.
Hussein Baoumi is an Egypt researcher with Amnesty International. He's been speaking with us from Tunis. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Major League Baseball is finding a way to salvage a season. It ain't over till it's over. But the running world got a double hit of bummer news today. Both the Berlin and the New York City marathons announced that they are canceled over coronavirus concerns. Those concerns are significant. Consider the crush of runners who were on the starting line last year at the Berlin Marathon.
Today, nearly 40,000 runners from 150 nations will be on the start line. The popularity of this international event continues to grow and grow.
Los kids! Berlin is one of the world's six major annual marathons. Two of the others, Chicago and London, still have dates on their calendar for October, but Tokyo, Boston, Berlin, New York all canceled, leaving tens of thousands of runners to wonder, when will it be safe for us to stand shoulder to shoulder again at the starting line and for fans on the side of marathon routes everywhere to cheer them on? We'll have to wait and see. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. When the pandemic hit this spring, American colleges sent hundreds of thousands of international students home. Come fall, many will not be able to get back to campus because of travel and visa restrictions. It's leaving some universities bracing for a steep drop in enrollment. WGBH's Kirk Carapezza reports.
When Northeastern University in Boston shut down abruptly in March, sophomore Pavithra Rajesh frantically packed her bags and boarded a plane home to India.
I'm a very careful planner. So telling me that within 3 days, you have to figure out where you're going to go, move things into storage, it was pretty nerve-wracking.
At home, Rajesh quarantined herself in her parents' apartment in the southern city of Bangalore for 14 days. The journalism major and theater minor took her last 3 weeks of spring courses online.
Suddenly, I had to think about coming home and doing musical theater classes over Zoom. Nothing stopped me from dawn till bedtime. And reporting over Zoom, interviewing people. Every night, I was up till almost 3 a.m., 4 a.m.
Bangalore is 9.5 hours ahead of Boston. Looking ahead, Rajesh and her parents worry about her coming back to campus in just 2 months.
I'd be transiting through 3 very crowded airports. The U.S. has quite a lot of cases. It's pretty vulnerable right now.
So are the finances for universities in the U.S., like Northeastern, where a third of all students come from abroad, many from India and China, with most paying full freight. Colleges were already losing international students because of the anti-immigrant political environment. Now they're bracing for even more losses. The Trump administration has been tightening travel and visa restrictions on foreign students and workers. Add to this a pandemic that's blocked many international students from traveling back to the States for the fall semester. It's created a lot of confusion.
The pandemic, as well as the political difficulties between China and the United States, has ushered in a period of enormous uncertainty.
History professor Bill Kirby teaches Chinese studies at Harvard. He points out nearly 90% of colleges expect international enrollment to decrease next semester.
Some 70% anticipate that some international students will not be able to get to their campuses this fall.
Kirby says the virus and the situation on campuses is damaging the country's global relationship with China, India, and other foreign countries.
Parents always worry about the health of their children. Is this a healthy place to send your child? And so I wouldn't be surprised to see at least some pause sending students to a place where the public health systems are clearly not as robust as they are in Europe or Japan or Korea.
And if international students take their studies and cash elsewhere, that would have devastating effects on the U.S. economy.
We are, particularly in higher education, in a highly globalized and interdependent world.
Philip Altbach is the founder of the Center for International Higher Education at Boston College.
International students spend a lot of money in this area, not only the direct tuition cost for universities, but also other expenses that they have around town.
Altbach says colleges that are overly dependent on international dollars are going to take a big hit. In Boston, Northeastern University recently announced that its campus and dorms will reopen in the fall, and students will have the option to take classes in person or online or a mix of both. Sitting in her room in Bangalore, Pavithra Rajesh says she's eager to get back in the classroom.
For me, doing 3 weeks of online classes from India was hard for sure. I don't think I could do that same thing for 3 months.
Still, she's skeptical about whether students packed into dorms are willing to follow social distancing guidelines and wear masks. For The World, I'm Kirk Carapeza, Boston.
These are the streets of Moscow today. More than 13,000 military personnel marching in Red Square in close formation, mostly without masks. Russia's World War II victory parade. 6 weeks late, President Vladimir Putin postponed the celebrations, the country's largest public holiday, because of the coronavirus pandemic. So it is a strange victory day this year, but perhaps not as strange as how it went in 2007 in Estonia, a former part of the Soviet Union, and how it felt being on the receiving end of an early Russian salvo of cyber meddling. 2007 was when Estonians removed a statue that commemorated Soviet victory in World War II. Some saw the statue as a symbol of Soviet occupation. In her new book, How to Lose the Information War, Nina Jankowicz says that removing the statue laid the groundwork for Russia's disinformation campaigns.
There's evidence that Russia, the embassy, its security services instigated riots that happened in 2007 around Victory Day and the moving of this statue, and then a cyber attack, which took down many Estonian media outlets. It took down parts of the Estonian government and banking system. And as a result, Estonia was one of kind of the warning signals that this information war that we find ourselves in was coming.
there's this troubling scene where lawmakers in Washington were kind of asleep at the wheel in responding to the 2007 Russian cyber attacks on Estonia. Do you think now Washington is alert enough to the meaning of the entire constellation of threats to democracy in cyberspace, whether it's coming from Russia or anywhere else?
I think we are waking up. Unfortunately, we're still in bed, though, Marco. We've not fully gotten out of bed and really washed our face and clearly faced the threats of the day. Something that worries me every single day is the fact that disinformation has been politicized by both political parties in the United States. We need to recognize that it is not one political party that is going to always be victorious because of Russian or any other foreign disinformation. The ultimate victim is democracy. This is not a partisan issue. And we need to equip our citizens, equip our lawmakers with that understanding that we will not stand for foreign interference or even domestic interference that is misleading voters about things like polling place locations and voting times. We're seeing all of this happening because disinformation has been democratized, and we need to fight back against that. And unfortunately, the Russian playbook is open to anybody who wants to use it, anyone with a social media account and a credit card. This stuff is not hard to do, and it's becoming more and more rampant unless we act soon.
So you describe combating Russia's disinformation techniques through whack-a-troll, kind of like the game whack-a-mole. Explain that, Nina.
I think what we, the United States and many other countries in the West, have done so far is we've tried to fact check. We have tried to remove inauthentic accounts and inauthentic content from the internet. And that is a losing strategy because Russia is happy to allocate as much resources as necessary, whether those are human resources or monetary resources, to pump the information ecosystem full of misleading and divisive content. Their strategy isn't, you know, a grand strategy where they know exactly what buttons to press at every time. It's more like spaghetti at the wall. They throw it and they see what sticks, and then they keep throwing that same sticky spaghetti over and over. And social media empowers them. It makes them able to do that. So rather than playing whack-a-troll, I argue that we really need to invest in solving the root causes of these problems, solving what makes us so vulnerable to Russia in the first place. We need to heal the fissures in our society and heal the polarization that Russia weaponizes. But it also means investing in things like media literacy, digital literacy, civics, and, you know, restoring a democratic discourse, not only online, but offline as well. These are things that are generational investments, of course, but it's important that we start them now because as the story of Estonia in 2007 shows, this has been something that Russia has been at for generations, and it's time that we catch up.
Nina Jankowicz, the author of the soon-to-be-published How to Lose the Information War. Nina, thanks very much as always.
Thank you, Marco.
You're listening to The World. In Thailand, when companies advertise alcohol, they can say what the drink is and how much it costs. Anything beyond that, you could face steep fines.
Basically, we said it was really refreshing, and we were hit with that keyword.
New drinking rules during a pandemic. Religious conservatives fight to make them permanent. That's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH, and PRX. Lebanon is a small country in size and population, not even 7 million people. Considering its size, Lebanon's got a huge number of domestic workers, about 250,000. Most are from Ethiopia. They come to Lebanon to earn money to send back home. But as the Lebanese economy sinks deeper into crisis, many employers there say they can no longer pay these workers. From Beirut, Rebecca Collard has our story.
Outside the Ethiopian embassy, Mesaret Shafar is washing a pair of socks by hand using a bottle of water. Then she rinses her feet. I just want to go to Ethiopia, she says. Shafar is one of about a dozen Ethiopian women waiting outside the embassy building. The women shelter from the sun under a small overhang. Their suitcases and bags are stacked against the wall. One woman holds a sign written in Amharic. It says, "We want to go home." In the past month or so, about 100 domestic workers have shown up here, some with no money, no passport, and no realistic way to get home. The Beirut airport is closed to regular traffic, and so are the doors to the Ethiopian embassy. Shafara says her employer dropped her off here, and she's been sleeping outside for the past 3 nights. She says she came to Lebanon 2 years ago to work in the home of a family in Beirut. Like most domestic workers from abroad, she lived in the family's house. She cleaned and helped with the children. But a few months ago, she says her employers told her they could no longer pay her, and they stopped. That's a long time to be working for free, Shafara tells me. She says her salary was just $150 per month. Lebanon's economy is in a state of collapse. The currency has lost around 3/4 of its value against the U.S. dollar. The price of almost everything is shooting up. And for many Lebanese families, paying domestic workers in U.S. dollars is now suddenly 4 times as expensive as it was just 6 months ago. Farah Selka is an advocate for domestic workers. She's with Lebanon's anti-racism movement. She says the financial crisis is bringing new attention to an old racist system under which foreigners have been exploited here for decades. It's called the kafala or sponsorship system. And Selka says it's a lot like modern-day slavery.
So basically, the sponsorship system allows you to employ a worker, they say, but it's basically to own a person in your house and to make them work in whatever conditions you see fit.
Selka says Lebanon's labor laws do not apply to domestic workers because they're not seen as workers.
It's a disaster because these people can't stay, they can't leave, they can't work, they can't pay.
Selka says it's difficult to know how many women have been discarded by their employers with no way home, but she reckons it's been hundreds in the past month alone. And as the financial crisis gets worse, she says more and more workers will be abandoned.
Most of these sponsors are getting rid of their workers, literally, as though they are trash. What we're seeing at the Ethiopian consulate is only the tip of the iceberg of what is yet to come. We are in the beginning of the crisis. We haven't even gotten midway yet. And what we're seeing at the consulate, it's the most visible with Ethiopians because they are the biggest community, but this is happening with all other nationalities.
The majority of the 250,000 or so domestic workers in Lebanon are from Ethiopia, but they also come from Sri Lanka, the Philippines, and other African and Asian countries. Many of these women, and they're mostly women, are owed months of wages. Selka says they have little recourse legally. Some have also suffered forced confinement, physical and mental abuse, even rape. On average, one domestic worker in Lebanon dies every week, and many of them from unnatural causes. At the Ethiopian embassy, most of the women I speak with say they're just looking for a way back home. Asanagath Lalithio says she was not dropped off here by her employers. I ran away and came here, she says. I have my passport but no money. She says her employer stopped paying her 4 months ago. At one point, a Lebanese woman shows up saying she wants to hire one of the women to come work in her home. She promises that she'll pay in U.S. dollars, but no one is interested. Ethiopian Airlines has organized repatriation flights, but the tickets cost around $1,000 each, far more than any of the women here have access to. They tell me they just hope someone will intervene to help them find a way out of Lebanon and back home. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
This week, 10 children arrived in France from Syria. They all have at least one French parent but had never set foot in France before. It was not entirely clear what sort of welcome they'd receive. That's because the youngsters are the sons and daughters of ISIS fighters. The children had been living in squalid detention camps in northeast Syria. Some are orphans. Others had been relinquished by their mothers. Amarnath Amarasingham teaches at Queen's University in Ontario in Canada and has been a frequent visitor to these camps. I asked him to describe the largest one. It's called Al-Hol.
It's just a sea of children under every rock, under every tent. It's just kids everywhere. There's also this added element of certain women from regions like Chechnya, Russia, and North Africa who are trying to control other women in the camp, particularly Westerners. And so you do have that added difficulty of a whole host of women who are trying to recreate in many ways the caliphate that they lived under. and are kind of ruling the place with an iron fist.
Right. So different levels of allegiance to ISIS still, women who've kind of rejected and others who are still very much part of the cause.
Yeah. A lot of these women have also told their children that, you know, these soldiers who are guarding the camp are the ones that killed your parents, right? Or the ones that killed your dads, which is absolutely true. But what that does in the camp is all these children are now throwing rocks at the Kurdish forces. And so it becomes this kind of chaotic environment that is hard to manage by just 400 Kurdish forces. Weapons are being smuggled in. When I was there in October, you had an actual gunfight happen between Kurdish forces and some of the women. There were rumors that the women themselves had guns, which turned out to be false. It's just a chaotic environment with a lot of these children who are suffering from malnutrition, are getting sick. We've had several hundred die since the opening of the camp in early 2019. Just from a basic humanitarian perspective, I mean, these kids are going through hell and they should be repatriated. But most countries are not making that move to bring their children back.
Some of the women sound quite desperate. I'd like us to listen to a video from a mother who posted on Twitter this week. We can't verify all her details. She says, though, she's a detainee at Al-Hol camp. She's covered in the video from head to toe in black and is filming from inside a tent. She says she has three kids, and she thanks people for sending her donations.
We have injured sisters here. We have sick people who have no means of making an income in this place. It makes our life very difficult to provide for our orphan children and our small children that we need to take care of.
Amarnath, what do you make of that?
Yeah, there used to be a kind of hawala system, which is a traditional money transfer system that existed in the camp, but that has been shut down as far as I could tell.
Well, there's another tweet from a similar setting. Another woman in a veil, she's holding up a piece of cardboard with a handwritten message that says, "We are two sisters from Camp Al-Hol, and we are trying to escape. We have collected $13,000, and we need $3,000 more. Please donate." So in lieu of repatriation, are women like this trying to break out? And is the money to pay smugglers?
Absolutely. I mean, I used to be in touch with several of the women inside the camp even after I returned to Canada. And that was an ongoing conversation that there is evidence that smugglers are active in the camps and outside the camps. And some of these women do start to disappear. It's not entirely clear where they would go and what would happen to these children.
If Western nations and other countries are prepared to let these families spend the rest of their lives in these squalid camps, what is their fate?
That's a million-dollar question. I think no government, no prime minister, no president wants to run for re-election on the platform of, oh, I just brought hundreds of ISIS fighters back home.
The but reluctance, they're not, I think, ISIS fighters. They're the children of ISIS fighters.
Yeah,
many, I think, of them born after those fighters went.
I think public support for bringing the children back is pretty strong. It's only when you add the women and the men that public support tends to decline. There has been some instances of uncles, for example, from Canada and other places going to Al-Hol camp and offering to bring their nephews and grandkids back. And the mothers in the camp basically said, I'm not giving my child to a non-believer, to a kind of infidel government. It should be a no-brainer to bring these children back. It's just mind-boggling to me that we're just leaving hundreds and hundreds of children in these squalid conditions indefinitely with no real discussion about how or when to bring them back.
Amarnath Amarasingam researches extremism and teaches at Queen's University in Ontario. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
As countries scrambled to keep the coronavirus under control, a few places tried a novel solution, banning alcohol. Keep people sober and alert, the thinking went. South Africa did it, so did Greenland and parts of India and Thailand. All those bans have come and gone, but in Thailand, a temporary ban has emboldened conservative Buddhists who want to make it harder to get a drink permanently. Here's the world's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
Not long ago, a bar owner in Thailand got a letter, the sort of letter no one likes to get. It said, "You've committed a crime, and now you're wanted for questioning."
They basically asked us to come in for interrogation.
That's Nix Anuman Ratchadon. He owns a few bars in Bangkok and a spirits import company called Vice Versa. And that letter, it tells him to come see the government's alcohol control panel. So he does. And the officials there say, hey, on your social media, you've been boasting that the alcohol you serve is tasty. They say the only thing you're legally allowed to publicize is the name of the drink and the cost.
That's it. Nothing more, nothing less. You can't say that the spirit has been awarded. You can't say that it has hops, it has this or that. That would be trying to make people drink more.
That's the crime, inducing people to drink. Something bar owners might tend to do. But under a Thai law that is sporadically enforced, this is forbidden, especially on Facebook or Instagram. And it's strict. If anyone takes a selfie with a bottle of beer or whiskey in their hand, that's illegal. You're inducing people to drink. Nix asked, well, what did I say exactly? The officials told him his offending phrase was jin chidang. That's Thai for famously good gin.
Jin chidang, like renowned gin. That's it. They hate it so bad.
In recent weeks, Thai officials have been summoning a lot of people, hundreds, bar owners, beer importers, even a blogger, and hitting them with charges, to which most have said, really? I'm in trouble for this?
It's quite universal, you know, like if you have a beer and if you post a beer photo and you're inviting your friends to have a drink with you, like that is not supposed to be illegal. We're not selling drugs here.
When foreigners think of Thailand, they often think of stuff like this. Big parties, a freewheeling place where you can let loose and get tipsy, which sure you can, but what tourists don't always see is that there is a force pushing back against anything boozy. Devout Buddhists frown on drinking. One government agency makes these TV ads, rolling them out before Buddhist holidays, like Kalpansa or Buddhist Lent, a time when people are urged to give up their vices. In this ad, the voiceover says, getting drunk during Buddhist Lent is a major sin. A guy on screen who looks wasted, he says, no, it's not a sin. And then his skin starts sizzling, and he is plunged into a flaming Buddhist hell. Yeah. Nix, the bar owner, he had to pay a fine. A fine that helps pay for more ads like this. About $1,600. Screw up again, they said, the fine gets doubled. I spoke to someone else who got fined, Lee Sichin, who goes by Lee. He's the managing director of Beer Vana, an importer of craft beer. And at his interrogation, he also asked, what did I say about my beer that's so bad?
Basically, we said it was really refreshing, and we were hit with that keyword.
Refreshing, not allowed. Also, a $1,600 fine. He was told almost anything his beer company might put on Instagram is a crime.
They said even if one person saw a picture of your beer or logo, it means you're trying to get them to buy the product.
Which is exactly what he is trying to do. So why is this happening now? Well, the government says they're just enforcing the law. But the conservative anti-drinking faction, they've had some big wins lately. 2 months ago, when COVID-19 cases were going up and up, the nation banned alcohol for 20 days. And they almost got 50 days. Not just selling booze in bars, but everywhere. Full prohibition. So they're feeling bold, seeing how far they can push it. Lee says, surely this is too much.
It's a personal right for people to post or talk about things that they like. Why is alcohol considered not okay for people to post about? Because political views is the same thing, right?
So far, they've mostly gone after bar owners, alcohol businesses, celebrities. But there's nothing stopping officials from fining or technically jailing some poor schlub just holding up a beer on Instagram. Or even a tourist, clueless about the law. Nix, the bar owner, says at this point, they don't seem to be backing down.
Now it's so unclear. So anyone can get fined for anything. It's not supposed to be like that. They can abuse this law like easily.
For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
No doubt you've noticed there is a lot of news these days. Here's one more way you can keep up with what we're following. Start your morning with a quick hit of news stories from around the globe. Sign up for our morning newsletter, Top of the World, on our website, theworld.org/newsletters. Again, that's the world, one word, theworld.org/newsletters. Think Spanish literature, and you may be thinking Don Quixote, but there is so much more to classic Spanish lit than The Man of La Mancha. A new exhibition at the Cervantes Institute in Madrid looks at some of the most important but largely ignored women writers of Spain's 16th and 17th centuries. Ana Rodriguez Rodriguez is the curator of Both Wise and Valiant. She joined us from Madrid.
What is surprising is that we haven't known many of these female writers until very recently. They are better known now in the academic world, but not so much for the greater public. And I think that's something we have to keep working on. And that's the idea of this exhibition. Let's bring these names, these writers, their realities to the greater public so that they know more about their own tradition, about their history, about the literature that has been produced in Spain, also by women.
So this exhibit highlights some pretty extraordinary figures who had some amazing adventures, really. Many of these writers were nuns. What do you think that is? Did nuns like have more freedom than the average Spanish woman at the time?
Actually, nuns are the majority of female writers in these two centuries. 80% of women who wrote in the 16th and 17th century in Spain were nuns. One of the most important reasons is that in the convent, which you usually see as a space of confinement and lack of freedom, at the same time, it opened the opportunity to be in touch with books, in touch with time. To have time for writing is very important, as we all know. And if you're a woman who has to get married and is a mother or a wife, it's not proper that you spend a lot of time writing or reading and thinking about culture if you are supposed to be a mother or a wife.
Well, there are a number of writers you highlight in this exhibit who challenge norms around gender expression. There's a figure known as the Lieutenant Nun, Catalina de Arauzo, who had a pretty astonishing life. How was she viewed?
Catalina de Arauzo is one of these fascinating characters that we still need to keep thinking about and discussing, because I think this person teaches us many different lessons that they are good for our understanding of gender, even nowadays. Catalina was born a female in Spain, but she was one of these women that was confined into a convent very young, like at 4 years old, if I remember correctly. But she escaped the convent, and she decided that she wanted to live like a man. So she dressed as a man, and not only that, but she traveled to America, to the colonies, in order to be a soldier over there. So we're talking about a person who is always in search of an identity. Sometimes when you read her autobiography, sometimes you can feel that she or he or they speak as a man, sometimes as a woman, and she's always struggling with how to identify herself or himself or themselves.
I mean, I use the pronoun she, but what does that suggest, and what would you suggest?
I have always the tendency to use the feminine pronoun, because normally we talk about Catalina as a female writer, so I think I've been influenced by that. But I think that we could decide that using she or he is not even appropriate. I think we could use, in this specific case, they, because I think that responds better to the reality that this character lived. So complexity and richness all over Catalina de Arauzo, right?
You also look at the friendship between novelist Maria de Zayas and playwright Ana Caro. Who were they, and was theirs a friendship that you think would seem familiar or resonate today?
We're talking about two very prominent writers, wonderful quality in their texts, very well known at the time, but they had many, many difficulties in order to succeed because of their gender. And they realized that very soon. So what they did is basically promote each other. Maria de Zayas talked about Ana Caro in her books, saying wonderful things about her, and Ana Caro did the same things about Maria de Zayas. I think that that's a wonderful example of female solidarity in the middle of oppression, which is what they really have to go through.
Are these writers well known in Spain today, and are you hoping this exhibit will help them find new audiences in 2020?
The canon has been very, very male-oriented for forever, I can say forever, until very recently. And it's really time to make these women known, and not only because they are women, but because they offer us wonderful texts, high-quality texts that we have been missing since we have been studied this time period. And this is a way we can make some change and give them the fair treatment that they have been missing for centuries.
Ana Rodriguez Rodriguez is the curator of the exhibit Both Wise and Valiant at Spain's Cervantes Institute in Madrid. Ana, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
An earthquake shook central Mexico yesterday, killing at least a half dozen people. Buildings shook as far away as the capital. As the world's Jorge Valencia reports, millions of people got an advanced digital warning thanks to Mexico's seismic alert system.
Mexico's government keeps earthquake sensors along the country's Pacific coast, and they shoot out a signal when they detect the ground is about to move. Antonio Uribe Carvajal is the former chief seismologist for Mexico's Federal Electricity Commission.
So when the signal comes, you have speakers all around the city. There are about 15,000, which go, wow, 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 earthquakes coming, earthquakes coming.
Warning people is one thing, but Uribe Carvajal says educating them is another. About 30 years ago, schools and universities began having drills. You're supposed to remain calm and determine where you will seek shelter depending on how close you are to the ground level.
So there's a generation that has been trained with drills.
The earthquake yesterday had its epicenter in the southern state of Oaxaca, and people in the country's largest metro area, Mexico City, home to 21 million people, got an advance warning of at least 62 seconds, according to the National Seismological Service.
Yesterday was a very big success. But you can say, okay, there was no collapses, there was no building damages in Mexico City. Yeah, but the fact is, as a drill, it worked perfectly.
And it is a terrifying drill. If you experienced the September 2017 earthquake in which 370 people died, the seismic alarm is the last thing you ever want to hear. I was there. It's like, wow, wow, wow. Just apocalyptic is the best way to describe it.
No, ahí sí me, literal, me discúlpame la expresión, pero la verdad sí
me dio mucho miedo. I was expletive scared, says Evelyn Boyoli, a fitness coach who lives near downtown Mexico City. But she says the alarm gave her enough time to walk out of her second-story apartment with her dog, whose name translates to Fluffy. Here's seismologist Uribe Carvajal.
The people that have suffered big earthquakes that have a lot of damage and have heard the sound, doesn't matter what kind of sound it is, it's going to scare people if you already heard them and you know what the consequences are.
In Mexico, it's prohibited to use the sound for anything other than the seismic alarm. If you really want to hear it, you can find it on our Twitter feed. We're at The World, though I don't recommend it. The whole point is that when you do hear it, it will get your attention. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you back here tomorrow.